This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
The White House has become the East Coast branch office of ExxonMobil and Peabody Coal, and climate change has become the preeminent case study of the contamination of our political process by money.
Two deadly myths made it to the top. From Australia, leading scientist Andrew King finds climate change will continue for 1,000 years after net zero. Swedish scientist Wim Carton introduces us to his new book with Andreas Malm, Overshoot, How the World Surrendered to Climate Breakdown. The late great journalist Ross Gelbspan told us what went wrong almost 20 years ago.
Radio EcoShock.
Winter is now spring, goes from cold snaps to heat waves, or a month of rain overnight. Welcome to the new world.
There was a plan to limit climate disasters. In 2015, 196 countries signed that plan in Paris. We are nowhere near it, but the hope was to find a resting plateau where the planet stops heating up. And that comes when we stop pushing more greenhouse gases into the sky than nature can absorb. It's called net zero. As famous Penn State climate scientist Michael Mann put it, warming ends when carbon pollution stops. New science from Australia calls all that into question. Andrew King says Earth's climate will keep changing long after humanity hits net zero emissions. Dr. King is senior lecturer in climate science at the University of Melbourne. He's been working on this question and publishing papers about it for years. Now with 11 co-authors and new approaches, King finds climate change keeps unfolding for at least the next 1,000 years. From Melbourne, Andrew King, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. Thanks for having me on the show.
I'd like to begin with a local prediction from your team and then work back to the global picture. If, as you say, warming continues past net zero, what does that mean for Australia?
So we anticipate lots of climate changes continuing, even if we reach net zero emissions. The globe would continue to warm a little bit, but that's reflected in different temperature changes in different parts of the world. And Australia is, being in the southern hemisphere, a bit different from many other areas of the world. And we anticipate it would warm quite substantially, even under net zero emissions, more than other parts of the world, particularly southern Australia.
And I know that most climate studies are funded and written by people in the northern hemisphere. It's almost as if the other half of Earth is not important, but it is. What are the big changes that are particular to the southern hemisphere as the world continues to warm?
We anticipate actually quite big differences between the northern and southern hemispheres under net zero emissions. In the northern hemisphere, if we look at the temperatures that countries like Canada, the US, parts of Europe and parts of Asia experience, we're not really projecting big changes under net zero, maybe very slight warming for some areas. And Arctic sea ice is expected to stabilize under net zero emissions, roughly. Whereas the southern ocean, the southern hemisphere is a different story. The southern ocean is projected to continue warming for centuries, and Antarctic sea ice, quite differently from the Arctic, is expected to decline substantially even under net zero emissions. So very big changes ongoing under net zero emissions for the southern hemisphere, less so for the northern hemisphere. Of course, they're not really independent of each other. Changes in one part of the world can influence what happens in other parts of the world, but still quite a stark regional difference.
And as I said, Michael Mann has said warming ends when carbon pollution stops. And last year I checked that. I had trouble believing it myself. I checked it with expert Kevin Trenberth. He's in New Zealand now, and Kevin agreed. And when I raised natural feedbacks like carbon from permafrost thaw, Trenberg said the ocean's ability to capture carbon is so vast it can swallow natural sources as long as humans don't add more. Andrew, talk to us about your journey on this question and how you came to a different conclusion.
I was also kind of surprised when I learnt that this was the general consensus, that if we reach net zero, we stop warming the planet. It's kind of a conclusion that has had a lot of traction, I think, in the media, and it's quite an appealing thought. There are model experiments that suggest that climate changes under net zero might be quite small, but they're mostly quite short experiments, only for maybe 100 or 200 years. What I was interested in was taking a look at a slightly different scenario where we kind of test reaching net zero emissions at different points in the 21st century and run model simulations for 1,000 years rather than 100 or 200 years. We've only used one model, the Australian Earth System model. So, you know, that's a bit of a caveat. We would expect to see something a bit different with a different model potentially. But with our model simulations, we do see continued warming over many centuries and continued changes in the climate system. I would say, though, I don't think this is really quite a contradiction of what other scientists have said, like Michael Mann and Kevin Trenberth. They're mainly focused in those statements on global average temperatures. And we see quite subtle changes in global average temperatures. We do see continued warming. But the biggest changes we see in our experiments are in kind of regional changes and around Antarctica. And I think, you know, that was something that hadn't really been studied intensively. And I think our study only takes a look at this, but there needs to be much more work to understand Antarctic and Southern Ocean changes around under net zero emissions. So not quite like a contradiction as such, but there is a lot more complexity to just rather than I think maybe we should move away from just saying net zero means stopping global warming and just, you know, rather frame it as it, you know, being an essential step on the way to preventing dangerous climate change impacts or limiting dangerous climate change impacts. But you know, it's not the end goal. It's not the solution to all of our problems.
You know, reading the paper, one term that I had difficulty understanding, what is the difference between transient climate states and stabilizing climate states?
At the moment, our climate is very much changing very quickly because we're still emitting huge amounts of greenhouse gases. So the planet is warming very quickly and things are changing very quickly. So we would call this like a transient climate. But under net zero emissions, the changes do slow down. They can, you know, there are some changes happening still over time, but they are slower. And sometimes these kinds of climate states might be referred to as stabilizing or stabilized, you know, especially if the global temperature isn't changing too much. Ultimately, with the Paris Agreement, we're aiming to kind of obviously stop warming the planet and keep global warming as a whole preferably under 1.5 degrees and certainly well below 2 degrees Celsius. And that, you know, implicitly requires that we're not looking at a transient climate where we've got continued warming. We're looking at a future climate. We have to be looking to have a climate in the future which is stabilizing.
And another interesting aspect of your study, suppose we wait a while, as we are doing, and emissions increase, and then humans start working on reductions in a plan. We lose, say, 5 years when action was possible. Does that matter?
I think this was something we were really interested in looking at for this study. So we did run these experiments where we had 5 years delay in reaching net zero at different points in the 21st century. And the thing that surprised me is how big a difference it makes over 1,000 years. So even if we delay achieving net zero by 5 years, in hundreds of years' time, there is a difference in the climate system, quite a substantial difference in the climate system. And I think it just highlights how urgently we need to reach net zero, because even a few years of delay, it can mean quite big differences in ocean temperatures and around Antarctica especially, which could be, you know, really devastating. So I think it just highlights the urgency of needing to reach net zero.
And this is not just about temperature change. Could you talk to us about large-scale changes to how rain falls and where it falls as warming continues?
Yeah, so under climate change at the moment, we are seeing changes in rainfall patterns around the world. We're seeing some places getting wetter, other places getting drier, many places experiencing more extreme rain as well. So we wanted to have a look and see how rainfall patterns might change under net zero emissions. And it's, again, you know, this is with one model, the Australian Earth System model, and rainfall changes are quite model dependent. So this kind of needs to be followed up in other studies. But what we find in our study is potential reversals of precipitation trends in some parts of the world. So there are areas of the world like the Mediterranean, which is getting drier, which might, under net zero emissions, actually get a bit wetter, for example. The same is true for parts of Australia, you know, and many other parts of the world. So potentially quite big changes to our water cycle and hydrological cycle that we need to better understand, to really understand the implications of net zero emissions.
Yes, when water moves, humans have to move too if agriculture can't make it. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Australian climate scientist Dr. Andrew King. Your team ran 7 simulations looking at 1,000 years, that is deep future stuff. Why does the long future matter for humans now? What does it tell us?
So I think it tells us about how significant and long-lasting the impacts of our influence on the climate system are. So it's not so much about telling us about regional climate changes that we might experience over our lifetimes, but it does tell us about the impacts, the long-term impacts of policies around emissions reductions and the urgency of reaching net zero as fast as possible. And it kind of gives a warning as to kind of, yeah, these potential long-term climate changes that we might anticipate seeing that future generations will experience. It's our responsibility to not, you know, mess up the planet too much, I think. And, you know, it's really critical that we don't just do irreparable damage to the climate system over the next few years. So this helps us demonstrate how important reaching net zero as fast as possible really is.
You also looked into changes to the El Niño-La Niña cycle, known as ENSO, as the climate warms. Any tips on what you found there?
Yeah, so ENSO, the El Niño Southern Oscillation, is really an important mode of climate variability, has big impacts on many parts of the world. And we wanted to understand if it might change under net zero emissions. And again, with the caveats of this only being a single model, you know, the need for further studies, what we found was that we anticipate ENSO amplitude to decline slightly. So what that would mean is maybe slightly weaker El Niños in future and potentially then weaker impact on regional climates, but that's starting to get a bit beyond what we got to looking at in the study. But it's something we really need to understand. We need to understand the implications of our policy goals of reaching net zero, which we have to achieve. For countries like Australia, where La Niñas do really increase the chance of having flooding rains, and El Niños really increase the chance of having drought conditions forming. If we see a change in how El Niño and La Niña behave and how they impact Australia, that could have very large effects, which we need to better understand. So it's very much, at the moment, just a hint that we might see weaker El Niños and La Niñas under net zero, but we need to do more work on this.
Well, you can't include everything, but does your study include tipping points and feedback, so things like radical climate change?
Tipping points is obviously a really big topic and a big concern for humanity, really. We don't explicitly look at tipping points, but the assumption would be that in an Earth system model, if it's simulating the climate system well, if there really is like a tipping point, we should be able to see that in the results. We don't really see any very, very strong evidence for a tipping point in our simulations. It partly depends on exactly how you would define a tipping point. The fact that the Antarctic sea ice continues to decline rapidly under net zero emissions, by some definitions, could be viewed as a tipping point. But we're not seeing very large kind of non-linear changes in the climate system in our model simulations that would suggest other tipping points being triggered. Again, this would be something where if we ran other model simulations for very long periods of time, that could be useful for looking into the possibility of triggering tipping points.
But even if we get human emissions under control, this investigation suggests future warming might change the season. So what does that mean?
We did look at seasonal temperature and precipitation changes, and they are a bit different. The changes under net zero emissions are a bit different between if we're looking at northern hemisphere summer or northern hemisphere winter, for example. We're not talking about really large-scale changes to seasonal cycles, but kind of more subtle changes. But these changes on a local level could be quite important in some regions. If there are areas of the world which are very dependent on rains at particular times of year, and those rain-bearing weather systems move in such a way that they may experience more rain at one time of year and less in another time of year, that could have quite big impacts. It's not something we've looked at thoroughly enough yet, I think, to really say too much, but just to say that we need to study that properly because, again, seasonal changes could have big impacts and we need to understand any of the changes we really anticipate under net zero emissions.
Given your work, is there a stable spot for climate? Is there a resting zone for whatever survives?
At the moment, we're seeing really, really big, fast climate changes because we're emitting greenhouse gases at such a high rate. If we reach net zero, while we anticipate ongoing changes to the climate system, some of which could be really concerning and have big impacts, it's still much slower change overall than we're currently seeing. I think the point is that we shouldn't be really viewing net zero as just an end goal, because even if we achieve net zero, if we struggle to actually really have net negative emissions, so say we reach net zero and we can't really go much further than net zero, we do anticipate, you know, quite big changes, particularly to the ocean, to the cryosphere. We need to be prepared for those. But it's still, overall, we're talking about slower changes than in our current climate system. So I think, to answer your question, I think fundamentally we can't really stabilize the climate as a whole, but we can really slow down changes. And net zero is kind of an essential step on the way to doing that.
Andrew, what are you and your colleagues working on next?
Quite a lot of things to do with net zero emissions and also net negative emissions, where we are kind of studying whether, you know, how the climate might change if humanity is successful at actually removing more carbon than it puts into the atmosphere, which we're a long way off that. But we're trying to understand regional climate changes under these kinds of scenarios. Under net zero emissions, we really need to know how climate variability will change. We need to kind of understand the types of extreme events that different parts of the world might experience and how those might evolve. We don't really have a good understanding of that yet. My group, or the people I work with, and I'm very fortunate to work with lots of enthusiastic PhD students and postdocs on this kind of topic as well, we're trying to kind of answer the questions of how the climate will evolve under net zero emissions and net negative emissions in more detail than we've really done in this first overview study.
Dr. Andrew King is senior lecturer in climate science at the University of Melbourne. He's also the chief investigator of the ARC Centre of Excellence for the Weather of the 21st Century. And you can find links to his article in The Conversation and his paper in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Andrew, thank you for helping us understand.
No worries. Thanks for having me on the show.
For Radio EcoShock, I'm Alex Smith.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Mark Twain is supposed to have said there are three kinds of lies: lies, damned lies, and statistics. We are going to talk about damned and dangerous lies, I think, that we tell ourselves. We will fix climate change later, after we burn more fossil fuels. It is the myth of overshoot, and it's found in every climate agreement, official report, and business briefing books. Our guest, Wim Carton, studied it all, from new technology to the history of believing humans can rebuild the damaged atmosphere. He is the expert with dozens of papers and book chapters on carbon capture, geoengineering, and climate risks. Dr. Carton is Associate Professor of Political Ecology and Senior Lecturer at Lund University in Sweden. Along with co-author Andreas Malm, Wim's new book is Overshoot, How the World Surrendered to Climate Breakdown. From Sweden, Wim Carton, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. Thanks for having me.
A couple of decades ago, I recorded talks by Dr. William Rees in Vancouver. He had charts of fish in the sea and trees on land, everything showing humans taking far more than Earth can replenish. Rees and other ecologists called that overshoot. For this new book, what do you and Andreas mean by overshoot?
Yeah, so we talk about overshoot in a more narrow sense. You're right that the original meaning of overshoot is this kind of broader, you know, transgressing ecological boundaries that comes out of the especially ecological literature. We're talking particularly about crossing temperature targets. So within the climate literature, there's a whole conversation on overshoot, and there it means specifically going beyond thresholds that have been set by political leaders, of course. That's the kind of, you know, crudest, most simplest form of overshoot. But then if you dig a little bit deeper into this literature, there's also something that is kind of ingrained in how all of these pathways and attempts to kind of, you know, come up with ways of reaching temperature targets have come about, and all of them rely on what we call overshoot and return, or programmatic overshoot. And this is the idea that what we can cross these temperature limits, and then in the future use technologies to bring it back down to them by lowering temperatures again. So we play with this kind of double notion of overshoot and overshoot in return.
In your book, you do talk about three ways that this kind of spreads out. You say, in a way, it lets us accept that we're going to go beyond the safety limits, and it involves the belief that we will come back down, and then, of course, well, will it work at all?
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, so we talk about this in terms of overshoot ideology, in the sense that, you know, it's become this kind of widely accepted idea that, you know, we will be able to do this, and that this is in a way the only way to do it, right? The only way to, you know, reach these ambitious mitigation climate targets is to go through overshoot. That's become like the dominant idea, and it's a belief that is based on what we call this kind of unicorn technology. Right. I mean, a widespread of contraptions, I mean, both technological but also natural, that can suck CO2 out of the atmosphere. And the whole problem with that is exactly that they, for the most part, continue to justify and legitimize business as usual. So they kind of just provide an excuse to, you know, just keep going in the meantime, right? So the kind of fantastical nature of these technologies justifies this notion that we can just continue with business as usual in the near term.
In an article in The Conversation, you and Andreas say, quote, mainstream climate science endorsed the fantasy of a global warming time machine. So are you saying even top-level science, like the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change experts, bought into Overshoot?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, in many ways, Overshoot, in its kind of, you know, temporary crossing Overshoot and then coming down again, comes out of exactly this literature. So if you go back in time to, you know, some of the kind of the first IPCC reports in the early 2000s, so the fourth, around the fourth and fifth disaster report, then it's exactly there that the whole notion of overshoot came about in a way. So, I mean, what happened essentially is that at a certain point, political leaders came up with this 2-degree temperature limit, and then they went to scientists, in particular a group of modelers called integrated assessment models that are very kind of central in the work of the IPCC, and ask them to, you know, provide ways of reaching these 2-degree targets. And we can talk a lot about the details here. I'm not going to go into too much of it. But the models work in a very particular kind of neoclassical economics way that is, you know, rather conservative in terms of the boundaries that it works within. And so within those boundaries, they could not stay within 2 degrees because the model didn't allow for sufficiently rapid, I mean, capital destruction, for example, phasing out fossil fuel, all these things were not possible within the limits of that conservative model. And so what they had to do to kind of square that circle was to come up with overshoot. And this is where it originated, and then it got mainstreamed after the Paris Agreement. And from there, fed back into policy, and now, I would argue, also in a lot of, like, corporate reports and so on. So sadly, you know, part of the scientific community is definitely part of it.
And you look back into the history of this kind of thinking right back to the 1970s, and I found it interesting that at that time they were quite willing to say, well, look, this is a way we can keep on with our fossil fuel burning if we just have this overshoot idea.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is so in this book, Overshoot, that just came out, right, we talked about this particularly in terms of carbon capture and storage. So this original technology to put a carbon capture device on a fossil fuel power plant, for example. And in many cases, and this is still the case at the moment, right, this was meant to just, you know, produce CO2 that could then be pumped back underground to basically extract more oil and more gas, because you increase the pressure. And that's been one of the main ways of CO2 capture at a chimney for most of the history of this technology, actually. Because we have a second book coming, actually, it's going to be released next year, that delves much deeper into all kinds of other technologies as well, not just carbon capture and storage, but also these newer ones. And even there, if you go back to the 70s, right, it's very interesting how all of the kind of narrative in the 70s, 80s, and 90s was about how do we find ways to continue pumping and combusting fossil fuels by time, essentially, because mitigation, rapid phase-out, was just not seen as conceivable or politically desirable. So all these technologies had this at the core of their development narrative.
And then we had a series of pretty serious reports. I reported on them into the supposed safe limit of 1.5 degrees C of warming and the predictions it would come in the 2040s, and then that was sort of moved to the 2030s, and now the last 12 months are already over 1.5 degrees C. What is the next limit being proposed, and what do these limits mean? Is there any point to it?
This is a very good question. It's very hotly debated at the moment, even among scientists. I know just the other day there's been a few papers by people either trying to, you know, dismiss and downplay the role of these limits, and then others kind of fiercely defending them. So it's a very active debate. I guess there's two things here. I mean, one is that politically the 1.5-degree target has had, I mean, it's been a Trojan horse for overshooting for carbon removal. That's very clear now. But it's also had this enormous catalyzing effect, right? It came out of the demands of small island states and developing countries. It was picked up by the climate movement. In many ways, the kind of cresting of the climate movement after 2018 with Fridays for Future and so on was a result of this kind of momentum that built around, you know, this whole, I mean, also with the, of course, the special report on 1.5 degrees and so on. One can't deny that they've had a catalyzing effect. But they kind of create this notion of after 1.5 degrees, everything is, you know, either lost or, and that's of course not the case. There's everything to fight for after 1.5 degrees as well. I mean, politically, I guess, we see the COP is happening as we speak, the conference of parties, the UN negotiations on climate change in Azerbaijan. And 1.5 is still kind of being held on to, right? If you look at Paris, obviously, the next limit is 2 degrees, but there's no reason to, you know, think that after 1.5, we just have to accept that 0.5 degree. Many people say every tenth of a degree matters, and in many ways, of course, it does. And this is also what the special report by the IPCC very clearly showed, right, after in 2018, that, you know, 1.5 was important because the difference between 1.5 and, for example, 2 degrees is very, very significant in terms of extreme weather events. And now we also know increasingly the risk of tipping points, you know, the AMOC, for example, or, you know, the Amazon rainforest potentially reaching a point of collapse. It's not a cliff that you kind of fall off of as you cross it.
Alex will be right back with more on the myth of overshoot.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
We return to Dr. Wim Cardin on the dangerous myth of climate overshoot.
There must be supporters of overshoot. Who benefits if climate agreements depend on overshoot and governments go along with that?
I mean, the very clear answer is that the Saudi Arabias of this world and the, everybody who has stakes in continuing to extract oil and gas a little longer, those are the clearest beneficiaries, I would say. Because, the more we think that overshoot is the pathway that is going to bring us there, the more that we postpone phasing out of fossil fuels into the future, the more profit they can make in the meantime, of course. So they are the main people benefiting. And then, you know, the political class that is tied to that in many ways, in the case of Saudi Arabia very directly, but of course, even in a country here like Sweden, you know, there's a lot at stake when it comes to these very rapid decarbonization pathways. They're very unpopular, particularly by politicians on the right hand of the political spectrum, of course. They benefit from this as well.
Yes, you don't have to tell your voters that they're going to have to really cut back on fossil fuels because we'll fix it later. And that is almost the nature of politics, is to say we'll fix it later if they can. There is a growing chorus questioning overshoot, though. Wim, did you see the new paper in Nature led by Carl Friedrich Schleusner? It's titled Overconfidence in Climate Overshoot. Does that fit in with your work?
It really does, yeah. I mean, and this is actually this is a big part of it that we don't touch on in this book, but that we will have a lot to say about in the next book, and that's the whole question of tipping points, of course. And, I mean, what this new paper does is it shows very clearly that, I mean, firstly, you know, there's no guarantee that once we cross 1.5 degree or whatever limit we set, that we will be able to come back. There might be feedbacks or mechanisms being set in motion that mean that the climate system kind of takes on a different dynamic that means it becomes very difficult to kind of wind temperatures back again. That's one risk. I think the broader issue here is that whatever happens once we cross 1.5 degrees and in a potential scenario where we suck CO2 out of the atmosphere and lower temperatures again, maybe on a global average, that's going to be kind of a similar world in terms of, you know, temperatures, but regionally and in terms of ecosystem impact, it's very different, of course. I mean, you might have had species going extinct, all kinds of things will have happened, so the world will look very different, so the two are not the same. And the second part is that, you know, these technologies, carbon dioxide removal, which we would have to rely on to be able to bring us back after overshoot, they are, as I already said, you know, there's a lot of problems with them, but also, I mean, the scale at which we would need to do this raises a whole lot of questions, and so there's really a lot of skepticism within the scientific literature about the ability or even the desirability of doing this at the, you know, very large scale.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest from Lund University, Dr. Wim Carton. We are talking about the myth of overshoot and return in world climate. In your book, Overshoot, you and Andreas work through many lives of it, from economics through possible manipulation of the public. Did you consider the psychology behind such a dangerous giant mass delusion?
Not explicitly, but there's been, this is maybe there's a gap there. There's a bit more on this also in the second book, where we go a bit into kind of psychoanalysis, because, and we set this up a little bit, right? We talk about this kind of madness. I mean, it's hard to understand this continued move towards what becomes every day more clear is a very dangerous world and a very dangerous future. In purely, you know, economic analysis, for example, which is what the kind of theoretical framework which we use in the book. So you almost need psychology to help us understand this, yeah, as you say, mass delusion.
Well, I just wanted to suggest you could add a religious angle to overshoot, because religion builds on the human ability to believe in things that may or may not exist without proof. You do call fossil fuels a demon, and just for fun, I asked an AI, what do demons intend? And it listed five characteristics, and they're so spot on, I want to quickly read them to you. The first is temptation, leading humans into sinful behavior or away from virtuous paths. Possession, taking control of a human body or mind to cause harm or chaos. Deception, spreading lies or falsehoods to confuse people. Corruption, influencing individuals to engage in immoral or unethical actions. And finally, infliction of suffering, causing physical, emotional, or spiritual pain to individuals. That sure sounds like fossil fuel addiction to me. What about you? Is it a demon?
Yeah, that's fantastic. It's spot on. That's a very sound analysis, I would say.
So, again, in ancient Greece, when they had a messy ending for a play, the only way they could resolve it was with a god. So they dropped a god or goddess figure onto the stage, maybe with a crane of some sort. And that's the origin of the expression deus ex machina, god from the machine. And that is kind of how I see overshoot. It's like a contrivance to save us that may or may not exist. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, it is. And it may be, I mean, it goes for overshoot as such, and even, you know, for these carbon removal technologies, maybe most of all for this notion of solar geoengineering, which is also attached to this whole idea of overshoot. I mean, so the idea is that, you know, while we work our way across and then back from these temperature limits, we will somehow use a sulfuric shield in the sky to kind of temporarily dampen temperatures, and this will somehow, you know, help us maintain a livable climate while we suck the CO2 out of the air. And this is being discussed increasingly. There's a lot of, you know, political interest building in solar geoengineering, actually, concerning a lot of philanthropic and private capital flowing into research on this. And there, I think, we have a god from the machine, if ever there was one, because, yeah, there's a lot to say about that technology.
And suppose we give up the idea of overshoot. Where does that leave us, and when it comes to life-saving climate action and carbon reductions?
I mean, I think it just, you know, brings home this absolute necessity of, I mean, we talk about asset stranding in this book, right? This need to grapple with this enormous amount of fossil fuel capital that is fixed in infrastructure and, you know, in cars and everything. And we need a political program to be basically strand that in a way that is not socially destructive. And that's the kind of main thing. It's a very, very big task, of course. But it all comes down to, and this is the struggle that we continue to see at the UN negotiations and everywhere, right, that we need to move the message away from dealing with emissions and so on, to phasing out fossil fuels as soon and as rapidly as possible, because all of these kind of end-of-pipeline solutions come with so many uncertainties and risks and, you know, for misuse, that the simplest and, of course, the most politically unattractive solution as well is to just, you know, get rid of these fossil fuels. Now, I mean, I do want to say, so Andrea and me are not against kind of trying to use, so, I mean, the moment we have managed to do this and we have, you know, stranded the fossil fuel assets that need to be stranded, and we have won the battle on mitigation, and, you know, we're well on our way down to zero emissions, you know, we're not against exploring the idea of some kind of carbon removal solution. I mean, some exist. They have problems. But if we manage to kind of minimize them, there's, of course, no reason not to explore them at a later point. It's just that at this moment in time, the function that they fulfill is the one that we explore in the book, and that is this kind of fantastical kind of, we can continue to do whatever we're already doing because we have these alternatives. So we need to, I think, distinguish between the use of these technologies at different moments in time. In a utopian future, you know, there might be a use for them, but we're just very far away from that at the moment, and therefore something else needs to happen first.
Now, a couple of chapters in your new book cover rapid-fire climate disasters that are developing all over the world in the 2020s, and they come so fast, nobody can know about them all, and then we forget when the next one comes. And that sad list continues to accumulate in 2024. Why include that in a book about overshoot?
I mean, we struggled a little bit with this because, as you say, there's no end to this, right? One of the challenges with writing a climate book, when, you know, publications happen a year after we actually finished writing it. So, I mean, so much has happened in this last year, including, as you have said, you know, all of these more than 1.5 degree record temperatures globally, inevitably setting yourself up for having a very outdated list of disasters. I think we see somehow a normalization or even a numbing toward these disasters. And it's very easy if you read the mainstream media to not be confronted with them anymore because, you know, especially if they happen in the global south, often, you know, they're not being reported on. I think people just need to be reminded that this is our everyday reality already now. This is not something that is, you know, going to happen in some kind of distant future. Climate disasters are here, and they're already affecting a whole lot of people. So that's the main reason why we really, you know, wanted to put this front and center. This is ultimately why it matters, right? People's lives are at stake. People's livelihoods are at stake, and I think we need to keep that in mind with everything that we do when it comes to climate.
Yes, there were four typhoons hit the Philippines in the last 2 weeks, and that didn't even make it into the news around here. You wouldn't know it. So then you and Andreas explore a kind of last-ditch, tiny drop of hope. Maybe a great breakdown will open a door to real and necessary changes. I kind of went into this in a 2016 show that I called Can We Count on Catastrophe? And my guests there warned breakdowns don't always lead to a new dawn at all. Talk to us about your considerations about finding hope in crisis.
That's a very good point, and it's something that we've really talked a lot about. We just felt that at a certain point, you know, one has to think, okay, what would the alternative actually be? If we take this kind of asset stranding strategy seriously, it would entail some kind of massive breakdown. We see very often that in times of crisis, there's a moment opening up for what you could call a social tipping point, something happening very rapidly. Those are moments in which, you know, real change can actually occur. And the right has, you know, very often been very successful at kind of utilizing these, right, at what Naomi Klein calls the kind of shock doctrine. But there is absolutely, as you say, no guarantee that, you know, in a moment of crisis, especially not if you, you know, try to trigger it, you can control what happens next and that, you know, the outcome will be in any way desirable. It is maybe even likely that the opposite would happen. I mean, we acknowledge very clearly in the book that we don't have any kind of recipes for what to do. It's obvious that this kind of lightning bolt strategy is a kind of last-ditch attempt. I mean, for 1.5 degrees, as you already mentioned, it's maybe already too late. It's very hard to see what the alternative is, because the amount of capital invested, I mean, the amount of money flowing into fossil fuels is still growing. If you want to put a stop to that, you just need something very different from what is happening at the moment. The way we see it, a crisis is the only thing that could potentially deliver that.
As we wrap up our time here together, would you take a couple of minutes to tell us about your new book in the series, The Long Heat, Climate Politics When It's Too Late?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a book that basically really follows up from Overshoot. And it, two things. I mean, firstly, as I already mentioned, it kind of tries to explore the notion of reversibility. So as was indicated, for example, in that Meeker study, right, can we actually, once we cross 1.5 or whatever limit, can we actually come back to that temperature again? Is that possible within the current climate system? So we delve into that quite a lot and explore that. And secondly, we go into a lot of depth when it comes to these technologies for sucking CO2 out of the atmosphere. So we look at all of them and explore, you know, how are they currently being used? What is their potential? What are their drawbacks? And might there be some kind of progressive potential from them? And what we find very clearly is that, I mean, there's so many ways in which they're all being mobilized to, instead of, you know, sucking CO2 down permanently, to generate profit, either by, as I already said, enhancing oil recovery, or, you know, being used as offset, or, you know, to make synthetic fuels with the carbon that is being captured, or some other commodity. So we essentially, we talk about these three front lines. We say that after mitigation, after overshoots, the front lines of climate change are multiplying, and we will not have to struggle over only mitigation, but also adaptation, carbon removal, and geoengineering. And so we map what those struggles essentially will entail about, you know, how do we use these technologies, how are they going to be used by the people in power, and what indications are there already of it happening. That's what this second book is about.
From the University of Lund in Sweden, we've been speaking with Dr. Wim Carton. With Andreas Malm, he has just released the new book, Overshoot, How the World Surrendered to Climate Breakdown. This is not a narrow book for policy wonks. Our future is on the line. Find links to follow up in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Wim, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
The White House has become the East Coast branch office of ExxonMobil and Peabody Coal, and climate change has become the preeminent case study of the contamination of our political process by money.
That was Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author Ross Gelbspan. He passed away in January 2024, but his speech at MIT, November 19, 2006, nailed where we are right now. Here are a couple of clips from the event, Straddling Solutions and Survivalism, presented by Massachusetts Climate Action Network.
Ross Gelbspan, a seasoned investigative reporter, a tough thinker, and a scary truth teller. For 31 years, Ross Gelbspan was an investigative reporter and editor for the Philadelphia Bulletin, the Washington Post, and the Boston Globe. His work led to a Pulitzer Prize. Retiring in 1998, he wrote the book The Heat Is On, The Climate Crisis, The Cover-Up, The Prescription. President Clinton read it. His 2004 book is Boiling Point, reviewed in the New York Times by Al Gore. His latest speech was organized by Mark Breslow of the Mass Climate Action Network. The topic is Straddling Between Solutions and Survivalism. Getting published on global warming has been a challenge for even top-named reporters like Ross Gelbspan. He explains the huge gulf in media and public awareness between America and other parts of the world, particularly Europe. Other governments and publics have long recognized the dangers of climate change. This barrier to information in America has become a fixation for Gelbspan. He has taken a lead in exposing the corruption of the public mind, oiled by millions in propaganda dollars from the fossil fuel industry. He says the major media outlets are blinkered, seeing politics in everything, so they fail to cover issues outside the political sphere. Like science, for example, facts are not political.
The White House has become the East Coast branch office of ExxonMobil and Peabody Coal, and climate change has become the preeminent case study of the contamination of our political process by money. This fusion of corporate interests and government power has proved an almost insurmountable obstacle to the climate movement's ability to get its larger message across. So I think a really critical focus for climate activists should be on the press. And I know from my own experience that when the press covers an issue thoroughly and consistently, the public responds, laws get passed. I think in this case it would mobilize the public in 6 months. Unfortunately, the industry public relations specialists have been so successful in promoting equivocal and confusing climate coverage that the American public is about 10 years behind the rest of the world in this area. There are a number of reasons for this, none of them really justifiable. Let me just go through one of scores of these reasons for why the press behaves the way it does. One reason, I think, is the fact that the career path at the top of news outlets normally follows lies in following the track of political reporting. Top editors tend to see all issues through a political lens. Early in his administration, and this is one example, President Bush declared he would not accept the findings of the IPCC because they represent foreign science, even though half the scientists who contribute to the IPCC are American scientists. Instead, Bush called on the U.S. National Academy of Sciences to provide American science. What I found astounding was this. Even as the Washington Press Corps reported the story, not one reporter that I saw bothered to check the position of the NAS. Had they done so, they would have found that as early as 1992, 3 years before the IPCC declared that we are changing the climate, the NAS was pushing for strong measures to minimize the impacts of human-induced global warming.
Some of Gelbspan's most famous reporting exposed the links between fossil fuel corporations and a handful of paid scientists who implanted the impression of a debate within science about the human role in climate change. But there was no debate in scientific journals or among thousands of experts in the field. Gelbspan compared this effort to cloud our thinking to the public relations efforts of the tobacco lobby, who found experts to deny that smoking caused cancer. History may find the Exxon and Peabody lobbyists help kill more people than the tobacco industry as climate change unfolds in floods, heat waves, droughts, and storms. Some have argued that the foundation of newspaper sales and television viewers is controversy and conflict. So the media simply fell into their old model to sell the fake climate controversy supplied by public relations companies and their paid hack experts. Gelbspan, who knows the media industry as well as anyone, doesn't let the press off so easily. He says irreparable damage has been done to the planet while valuable years were wasted in denial, led by the mainstream media. As he digs away at the black dollars that bought time for ever-growing and excessive profits for the fossil fuel industry, Ross finds the media as guilty as the carbon kings. Let's listen to a few clips from his recent speech, starting with the fake debate.
The next reason has to do with this campaign of disinformation launched by the coal industry and carried forward by ExxonMobil. As I mentioned, the fossil fuel lobby paid a tiny handful of scientists to dismiss the reality of climate change. That campaign has had a profoundly corrosive effect on journalists by insisting this issue of climate change be cast as a debate, when in fact there is no debate whatsoever in the community of mainstream scientists. When it's a story involving opinion, a journalist is ethically obligated to give the major competing points of view their best shot, their about equal space, and their most articulate presentation. But when it's a question of fact, it's up to a reporter to get off his or her butt and find out what the facts are. In this case, we know what the facts are.
Reporters and editors, Gelbspan says, have broken the public trust on the environment story. As his speech develops, Gelbspan seems to say the public might be panicked if it knew the true extent of damage already done to the climate.
As one co-chair of the IPCC said to me, there is no debate among any statured scientists working on this issue about the larger trends of what is happening to the climate. That is something you would never know from American press coverage. But it is something you should point out to every editor and reporter you encounter as you work to get your message out. Stop approaching reporters like beggars asking for a handout. Let them know how angry you are at them for allowing themselves to be conned into betraying their public trust. One researcher who surveyed more than 300 peer-reviewed research articles a couple of years ago found that not one questioned the larger consensus about human-induced warming. By contrast, much of the coverage in the U.S. continues to cast this issue as a debate, and that's exactly what the public relations specialists of big coal and big oil want. They don't care who wins the debate, as long as the public perceives it to be a debate. And that way people can shrug their shoulders and walk away and say, come back and tell us what you know when you really know what you're talking about. To keep the issue framed as a debate allows the public to avoid confronting what can be a frightening and potentially emotionally overwhelming threat.
Gelbspan was asked to leave the audience with a note of optimism, but he changed his title to reflect the divided feelings many in the field hold. His new title, Straddling Between Solutions and Survivalism. I think we're going to need both, ways to survive a very bumpy transition to a carbonless, sustainable economy, even while we implement the solutions that will save future generations from hell on earth. We're going to get some of both, folks. There is a whole chorus of people, from net bloggers to senior scientists, who are thinking about survivalism if we can't adapt our political and economic systems soon enough. Things may fall apart.
Because of the success of this deeply dishonest campaign of information control, we find ourselves today in a sort of schizophrenic predicament. We are torn between the promise of solutions and the impulse towards survivalism. The situation is that dire. How are people of goodwill and social conscience supposed to respond in the face of a coming age of collapse? There is no body of expertise, no authoritative answers for this one. We are standing at the threshold of uncharted territory, and since there's no precedent to guide us, we are left with only our own hearts to consult, our intellectual integrity to look reality in the eye, whatever courage we can muster, and our uncompromising dedication to a human future that reflects the combined aspiration of every person in this room. So thank you all so much.
Find my full program on Ross Gelbspan's MIT speech in my show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith. Tune in next week for more Climate Voices the Mainstream Misses. Thank you for listening and caring about our world. We go out with my new song from the sea. It is a kind of green love song. Grab it free from my website, ecoshock.org.
Here before you were born as you dream.